Welcome to Sense and Sustainability, your podcast channel for sustainable procurement. We hope you like what you hear. Please go to www.iso2400.org for more information, learning resources, tools and much more.
So today I would like to introduce Ross Primmer from Action Sustainability. Ross has done a great piece of work pulling together a report to understand how the world has actually responded to ISO 2400 since it was launched in 2017. Hello, Ross.
Hi, Sean. Thanks for inviting me along to this podcast. It's nice to be here.
Okay. So, Ross, when we asked you to do this piece of work, the brief was fairly loose, I know, to investigate the use of ISO 2400 around the world. Can you pick up the story from there and tell us how you approach this piece of work?
Yeah, well, obviously, I was given a brief by yourself to say, look, you know, the ISO 2400 is coming up to its 50th year anniversary, and it'd be really interesting to find out about how is the standard being used around the world. You know, you had some really fantastic contacts through the ISO2400.org working group, and also some of the data that was available on the ISO 2400 website. And I sort of thought, well, okay, you know, we've got all these people who are using the standard. You know, let's get out there and start talking to them about what they've been doing, you know, what successes have they had, what challenges have they faced. And so I kind of worked with yourself and Carol Ann, who was fantastic assistance to kind of bring together a short list of people that we thought might be interested in contributing to the study. And yeah, kind of sent out some invites and ended up with a short list, I suppose, of about, you know, 25 people that I then went and approached and said, look, I really want to find out about what you're doing. And kind of then organised meetings over Teams to then chat through, you know, what they've been doing and how they've been using ISO 2400.
So it's nice to bring up and get on Teams and have a chat with people and get some feedback. But then comes the analysis piece. How did you approach that? Because, you know, I know from doing pieces of work like this, people will tell you loads of stuff. But getting from that to a kind of coherent and considered report, what did you need to do?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's an interesting one. So obviously, when you have, you know, interview data, qualitative data, analysing it is tricky. And actually, it's something that you know, I did go away and have a bit of a think about. I was really ably assisted by another one of your contacts, Dr. Erica Russell, who has some real experience in kind of qualitative data analysis. And essentially, one of the really fantastic things about working, you know, in a kind of Teams online environment is you can relatively easily get transcripts of what you're actually saying, and then you essentially go through a process which is called coding, where you try and look at key themes in your data. When I actually did my interviews, I had a series of questions that I would ask each person. I wasn't trying to be too prescriptive. They were more of a kind of guide for the conversation to try and get some kind of key themes from the actual data. And then, you know, the kind of coding part again is trying to look at those key themes. So was, you know, accreditation or guidance a really key theme in each discussion? Was there a kind of key theme around, you know, kind of there being a kind of real authority or lead figure in a country or a sector that maybe drives 2400? And then, you know, you kind of try to bring those statements together and kind of see where there's kind of commonality and where there's difference. So yeah, it's an interesting process, and it is something that I guess relies on the individual, the person, to try and be as unbiased as you possibly can to try and get those themes coming through. And I'd like to think that I've been as fair as I can be, but yeah, it was interesting to kind of, you know, trying to deliver, you know, get those themes across sectors. And actually, obviously, you know, we really had a global audience with this as well, so it was also trying to kind of find that commonality right the way across the globe, different sectors, different people, different organizations, to try and get some meaningful results for the study.
So let's talk about the findings. First question, does the standard actually work?
I think that one of the really key things that we can say is that pretty much consistently in every single interview, people think that the methodology that the standard presents is really, really effective and works really, really well. So I think, you know, it's definitely a big pat on the back for everyone in the steering committee and everyone who's worked towards a standard that the kind of framework is really, really good. I think kind of beyond that, you know, there's this kind of issue that the standard's still being driven by kind of key advocates in different countries. And that's something that we're, you know, I think we're kind of aware of anyway. You know, I think as a next step, there's definitely a piece to say, well, there are some organisations that really get it. And, you know, there might be some organisations that before ISO 24000, they might have been using BS 8903, or they might have been working on sustainable procurement. And they've kind of taken it like a duck to water, and they, you know, they're kind of integrating their sustainability teams and their procurement teams. Other organisations are slightly earlier on in their journey to deliver sustainable procurement. And I guess they're still kind of learning. They still kind of need to understand what the benefits are.
So we're saying the standard works, which is great. Are you seeing differences between size of organisation? And also, this is something that we tried to design to work in all cultures and in different countries and different areas. Were you seeing differences by culture and by size of organisation in how the standard is used?
I think that's an interesting one. And I think that in terms of size of organisation, and when we're looking at kind of, you know, use of it in different countries, I think there are some interesting observations from my report. So, for example, in France, they have developed their own sustainable procurement standard that they use in sort of conjunction with ISO 24000. I think that we probably need more research and more targeted data collection in terms of, you know, does 24000 work for an SME? And again, that's an interesting term in itself, because SME can mean a different thing if you're in Europe, or if you're in New Zealand, or if you're in, you know, North America. But I think actually a next step for any kind of future research into the use of ISO 24000 and sustainable procurement would be around that issue. What are the regional differences? What are the kind of, what's the difference between, especially between a larger organization versus an SME? Because, you know, an SME might have one person that does sustainability and procurement. They might just do sustainability, they might just do procurement, but a big organization will have a whole department. And, you know, how they adopt the standard, how they use it will be very different. But we need to probably do a bit more research on that to find out how they do it in the future, I would say. I will say one extra thing, though. I think what's interesting is that there are some countries, or again, this, I would say it's quite embryonic, this finding, but it's definitely something that came through. When you look at maybe some countries that have traditionally are a bit more powerful, for want of a better phrase, so the kind of places like the USA, they maybe are less kind of receptive of a kind of standard that's imposed on them. So they won't kind of outwardly say, we are aligning to ISO 24000. They're more than happy to use it and use elements of it, but they won't outwardly say that they're using it, versus maybe an organization or a country like the UK, where we're maybe a bit more receptive to kind of saying, oh, you know, we've got all these standards that we align to. And so outwardly on your kind of your website or in your kind of your procurement information, you'll say, you know, we have aligned with ISO 24000, we're doing XYZ to make sure that we're delivering sustainable procurement. So I think there's definitely that issue of, in some countries they are definitely using it, but they're not necessarily shouting about it for whatever reason.
Yeah, I think your report said that, didn't it? That, yeah. You know, the evidence is, or the potential evidence is, that there are people that you spoke to that use the standard, like it, apply it, but you won't find anything on their website, you won't find any public statements around it. So it's a tool rather than a badge, as it were.
Yeah. And I think that's another thing that definitely, you know, resonates from the conversations as well. I think you're probably going to ask me a question about this in a minute, but the issue of accreditation or guidance is a massive one. And I think it's something that, you know, organisations need to probably understand a bit more what a guidance standard actually means. But because ISO 24000 is a guidance standard, it has that flexibility, it has that ability to be a tool that you can use, you can sharpen it, and you can use it in the best way that you want to, instead of a kind of cookie cutter, this is how you do things. And I think, you know, it's interesting that when you talk to an organization that's early on its sustainable procurement journey, they might be more in favor of a kind of certifiable standard. They can say, yeah, we've achieved that, we've got it. But when organizations have been using it for a while, the fact that it is this tool and the fact that it is this great, great methodology that you can use to kind of shine a light into the kind of darkest depths of your supply chain, actually try and make yourself do things better, they really see the value in it. But you have to kind of go through that process, you have to go through that realization to actually work that out.
Yeah, let's go there. So as I understand it, yeah, there's a difference between a guidance standard and a requirement standard. A requirement standard is effectively a specification, and organizations can be accredited to certify businesses or other organizations, public organizations, against the standard. You can be audited, and you can get a pass-fail certificate on the wall, and you can be continually audited to say, yes, this organization complies with this standard, or, you know, no, it doesn't comply with the standard. It's a pass-fail. The guidance standard is what it says it is. It's guidance. You can't be certified against it. You can be independently evaluated, of course, but it's a journey rather than a pass-fail and certificate on the wall. You've already said some things about this, but it might be helpful to expand on it a little bit, because I think what you were finding was quite a dichotomy of opinion of the, yes, we love a guidance standard because, or we would really like a certified standard because.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, you've hit the nail on the head
what
there.
What did you find? What were the arguments for and against?
When you have a certifiable standard, you have that, you know, it is a tick box. You have that certificate that you can put on a wall, and it's something that you can say to your boss, we have achieved this. And a lot of people like that. They like that kind of definitive, you know, we've got this, you know, you put some money into helping us do it and we've got it. And then also you can say to your, potentially to your shareholders, to your clients, you know, we've met this standard, we've attained it. We've got a competitive advantage over our competitors because we've got this. When you have a guidance standard, it is much more of a, well, you know, we've read this standard, we understand it, and we are going to kind of look at how we can use it to make ourselves better. It's harder to have that kind of definitive value part of it, if that makes sense. People just find it harder to kind of get their heads around it. You can kind of cherry pick elements of it, or you can say, you know, this is relevant to us, this isn't, and then try and drive benefits that way. It's really interesting when you talk to procurement professionals who are, you know, maybe they've been in the sector for a really, really long time, and they kind of feel like they know everything. And then it's quite interesting to talk to them and say, well, actually, you know, we never even thought about sustainability, and we've kind of got our processes and what we do in place, but actually, you know, when these guys with a guidance standard, if they can say, oh we never realized that sustainability is something we need to think about, and then actually they can learn something from it and integrate what they need to what's most useful to them, that's where the guidance standard can be really, really valuable.
So obviously that there are arguments for and against, and this debate will go on for a long, long time, I suspect. So just moving on then to thinking about some of your other findings. There's quite a lot in your report about motivation to use the standard and why organizations align themselves with the standard. What were your thoughts on that?
Again, there's a really interesting mix there. I think there's some organizations that really want to show that they're kind of on the cutting edge of procurement, and they want to kind of be seen to be going above and beyond what the kind of standard is. And ISO 2400 gives them a real opportunity to say, okay, how can we push the boundaries in terms of, you know, what we're delivering to our clients? You know, I think there's also the issue that sustainability is just something now that's becoming more and more a key thing that organizations have to think about. So you have the procurement teams asking themselves, well, you know, we keep being asked these questions about sustainability. What do we need to do? I think there's also the issue around clients as well. I think that you know, just from the UK, you know, we know that there are some really big organizations or kind of projects coming up in the construction sector, like HS2, where ISO 2400 is something that's on their radar. And if you are, you know, if you want to work on these projects, then you need to show that you understand what ISO 2400 is, that you're aligned with it. And then obviously that's going to then drive organizations to kind of start looking at how they can use the standard. I think another really, really big motivator as well is that this kind of having these kind of key advocates in different countries. And, you know, obviously from a UK side of things, action sustainability, you know, the fact that we are seen as one of the sort of biggest purveyors of sustainability knowledge in the construction sector, the fact is that we're, you know, we've been the UK, or you particularly been the UK development partner for the ISO 2400 standard has meant that, you know, construction sector organizations have really kind of taken ISO 2400 on board. And now, you know, that's why there's a more of a concentration of 2400 users in the construction sector in the UK. I'd say you could say the same thing about, you know, Sarah Collins and Tanya in Australia. You know, they're kind of driving use in the public sector in Australia as well with 2400. So that's definitely a big driver.
So Ross, looking forward and moving into the future, the standard will undertake its 5-year review in 2022, where countries around the world in the ISO Federation have the opportunity to vote whether to keep the standard as it is, whether to ditch it completely, or whether to modify it. How do you see the opportunities for the standard over the next 5 years?
I think the opportunity side is a really interesting one. I think that the fact that the methodology is so consistently well received, it is something that we should really try and celebrate and kind of hold on to. So in terms of the kind of, you know, do we look at modifying the standard? I think my own personal view would be that maybe keep it how it is. I think that, you know, really for me, the next step is how can we kind of package and market the benefits that it can bring, and actually kind of really try and articulate to people who might be interested in sustainability or in procurement, you know, how to use the standard, what a guidance standard means, how can you actually use it to drive benefits in your organization. I think that one of the things that maybe it's a slight weakness at the moment is the fact that it's sustainable procurement. You know, is it something that should be applied by or led by the sustainability side of an organization, or should it be led by the procurement side of an organization? And just from my own personal experience, having been on a secondment with a quite a big engineering company in the UK for over a year, and seeing the conversations that happen between the sustainability team and the procurement team, and how it can be this kind of football that's it's quite difficult to understand who actually has the ultimate responsibility. I think that would be a really good development of 2400 to say, or if we can, some kind of this is how you apply it. I think that would help. Another thing I think that the standard would really benefit from as well is, you know, potentially trying to show how it links into other sustainability standards in the wider kind of remit. So when we think about things like ISO 26000, when we think about things like the UN SDGs, we know that the links are there. You know, these are other things that companies are talking about. But I think if we can actually maybe more clearly show how these things kind of mesh together, and how by, you know, 2400 plus 26000 plus looking at your SDGs can actually enable you to deliver more sustainability, I think that could be a real benefit. And I think that could be something that would definitely drive increased uptake and show those kind of tangible benefits that it can bring to organization as well.
I think the point that's been made in your report about accountability and who actually has the captain's armband for this agenda, as it were, in organizations is an interesting one, because for me, the standard makes it quite clear. And there's a nice diagram in the standard that sets it out really clearly. The fascinating thing for me was you interviewed a bunch of people around the world who are ISO 2400 advocates. It's not as if, you know, we were interviewing people that were new to the standard, but there seemed to be this confusion about which department it belongs to. Is it sustainability or is it procurement? The standard is quite clear. This is a procurement-led thing. And, you know, we tried to make it clear in the standard that, yes, procurement people need to take advice from experts on all sorts of subjects, including sustainability. But I thought the leadership thing was quite clear. But obviously it wasn't, because from your interviews, it suggests that people are still confused about that. So that again, is an I think opportunity obviously, yeah, to get that message across, isn't it?
It's an interesting one, because there are some organisations that have really taken it on board. And, you know, the classic example would be Balfour Beatty. You know, they've integrated their sustainability and procurement functions into one, which is, I'd say that's the kind of, they've got the gold sticker. You know, they've done a brilliant job there to try and drive sustainable procurement in their organization. But, you know, they were also involved in BS 8903, and they've been kind of practicing sustainable procurement for a really long time. So they're kind of more mature as an organization. I think that, you know, the flip side is where you have really big organizations that have really quite siloed groups of people, which are all doing fantastic stuff. But I think it's maybe that piece around even just getting the procurement team and the sustainability team to talk to each other, because they will need to work together. Even, you know, even if, you know, procurement lead on actually delivering sustainable procurement, you know, they can't do it without sustainability guys. And then, but they also need to know that they're going to need time from them, resource from them. They're going to maybe even have to think about developing kind of strategies and policies together to make sure that they're kind of aligning the sustainability objectives with the procurement objectives. And then when it comes around to things like tender questions for jobs, you know, the sustainability team might get a sustainable procurement question, and suddenly they're like, well, what do we do with this? And then, you know, you're on quite a short time scale and you need to talk to the procurement team, but they, you know, you might have days, and then they need to get back to you. And in a bit, and obviously this is a really big organization sort of situation, but it just creates a kind of even a bit of tension sometimes, and just having a bit more of a clearer roadmap about how it all fits together might benefit uptake and use and just understanding of how things are done.
So it's about collaboration and teamwork.
Yeah.
Ultimately. So final question then, Ross, if you could summarize your report in 3 bullet points, what would they be?
I mean, I think the key thing for me, number one, is that, you know, the methodology is fantastic. It's highly effective. It really works. I even had some people saying, you know, you can use the methodology that 2400 presents to really drive anything in an organization. You know, when you can't think about fundamentals and enablers and all that kind of thing, you can apply that to carbon or biodiversity or anything like that. So it's a really, really fantastic kind of keystone that the standard presents. I think, you know, at the moment, I think it's fair to say that really kind of use is driven by kind of key advocates and individuals. You know, it's not as ubiquitous as standards like 14001 at the moment. But, you know, the people that are driving it are really passionate about it, can really kind of show how it can deliver value and make organizations better at what they can do. So it's a really, again, a really fantastic kind of foundation to build from. And I think as well, you know, the key thing for me that came out in every interview is the conversation about, you know, accreditation and guidance, and how, you know, maybe the kind of the fact that it's a guidance standard is not universally understood yet, and you need that level of kind of consultancy or guidance to say, well, you know, this is how you do it. It works much better if you kind of engage with someone who knows about sustainable procurement and the standard before you start using it. You can't just pick it off the shelf and kind of say, what do we do?
Okay, Ross, thank you very much. Firstly, thank you for your excellent work. I know it's been a bit of a labour of love putting this report together and talking to everybody and analysing it. So thank you very much for your efforts. ISO2400.org is the place you can find Ross's report if you want some further information. So thank you very much, and we look forward to the next episode.
Thank you for listening to our podcast on Sense and Sustainability. Please listen out for more episodes. For more information, learning resources, tools, and much more content on sustainable procurement, go to www.iso2400.org.